Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
Experiences like this that led General Pete Schoomaker to compare JSOC during this period to a brand new Ferrari that was being kept in the garage out of concern that if it was taken out to race, the fender might get dented.
Joint Special Operations Command is set up to be the United States' ultimate problem solver, from rescuing hostages to capturing bad guys. Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 are part of it, but not the whole story. This week on War College, we get an inside view of the secretive organization.
You're listening to War College, a weekly discussion of a world in conflict, focusing on the stories behind the front lines. Here's your host, Jason Fields.
I'm Jason Fields, Reuters opinion editor.
And I'm Matthew Galt with War is Boring.
Today, we're talking with veteran war reporter Sean Naylor. He began his career writing for Army Times. He's written several books and is a contributing editor at Foreign Policy. His new book is Relentless Strike, The Secret History of Joint Special Operations Command. A recent review of the book goes so far as to accuse Sean of exposing valuable secrets that should have remained hidden. For a journalist, that's kind of a rave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
So could you just start off by simply telling us what the Joint Special Operations Command is?
Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC as it's more commonly known, is the command that runs the United States' most sensitive special operations missions. Examples include the missions that captured Saddam Hussein, rescued Captain Phillips from pirates off of Somalia, and killed Osama bin Laden. But as I explain in the book, those events are the ones that come to the public's attention. They are just the tip of the JSOC iceberg that has been created over the last 30 years.
Take us through a little bit of that beginning history, Sean. When did the Pentagon create JSOC, and why did it create JSOC?
The Pentagon created JSOC in late 1980 in response to the failed mission to rescue the U.S. hostages in Iran. You know, that mission was conducted by an ad hoc task force comprised of units unused to working together, with a similarly ad hoc headquarters running the show. And its failure was a huge blow to American prestige. And so to minimize the risks of a repeat, the Pentagon decided it needed a permanent counter-terrorist joint task force to run such missions from then on, and it established JSOC as that force.
Which special mission units are we talking about that JSOC controls?
The two best-known special mission units under JSOC's control are the Army's Delta Force, which was established in the late 1970s, a couple of years before JSOC, and the Navy's SEAL Team 6, which was created almost simultaneously with JSOC. Now, both of these units focus primarily on direct action, that is, missions that involve capturing or killing enemies and or rescuing hostages. But as I detail in Relentless Strike, over the years, their role as intelligence gatherers has also grown. And each of those units now has a squadron dedicated to low-visibility missions and intelligence gathering. But JSOC includes several other special mission units in addition to those two very well-known ones. The other ones include the Air Force's 24th Special Tactics Squadron, which coordinates airstrikes and provides pararescue medical personnel. Another Air Force unit that conducts what is called covered air, basically an undercover unit with civilian-style aircraft. And perhaps the most interesting of all, a unit that's gone by various names over the years, including since 2003, Task Force Orange as a nickname. And that's an Army unit that conducts human and signals intelligence gathering. And, you know, I have a chapter, you know, for instance, in my book dedicated to some of the very daring undercover work that Task Force Orange operatives did in Syria at the height of the Iraq War.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what they did?
They infiltrated Syria, I believe, prior to the onset of hostilities with Iraq, as part of a plan to try to get operatives in as many countries around Iraq as possible. Once the fight in Iraq became a fight against al-Qaeda in Iraq, that program of infiltrating U.S. operatives into, JSOC operatives into Syria was used to conduct espionage against the foreign fighters that were flowing through Syria and swelling the ranks of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. So, I mean, some of the stories I relate in my book, include, actually breaking into al-Qaeda foreign fighter safe houses in Syria with lockpick kits and copying all the data there and, you know, really old-school espionage stuff with disguises and secret recording devices on their persons and so forth and so on.
Stuff that sounds like a Mission Impossible movie, almost.
Yes, maybe. Probably with fewer explosions.
At least if things were going right. So can I just ask, I know it's going backwards a little bit, but JSOC and the Special Operations Command, because there is a separate Special Operations Command, is that right?
There is a U.S. Special Operations Command, but it did not come into existence until about 1987. So when JSOC was created, there was no four-star headquarters that had oversight of all U.S. Special Operations Forces the way that there is now with U.S. Special Operations Command.
Okay, so which actually is in control then?
Well, so Joint Special Operations Command is the command that is sometimes referred to as the National Mission Force, and when the U.S. government wants something accomplished in a particular part of the world, that it want, you know, it will give that mission, if suitable, to JSOC. U.S. Special Operations Command, for most of its existence, was a sort of what's called a Title 10 headquarters, which means that it was in charge of sort of training and equipping forces, but it wasn't an operational headquarters. Once a JSOC force was sent to the Middle East, for instance, it would come under U.S. Central Command. SOCOM is the administrative headquarters for JSOC, but it's not the one that's running the missions.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, all right, thanks. That helps a lot, actually. So during the first 20 years that it's been around, how often do they get to run missions? I mean, how often do these missions actually take place?
JSOC ran quite a few missions or conducted quite a few missions in its first 20 years, but they weren't the sort of missions for which JSOC was originally conceived. While JSOC personnel advised other countries' special operations forces, who were conducting hostage rescues in places like Sudan, Thailand, and even Curaçao. The closest JSOC got to doing its own missions of that type was in 1985, when the command twice deployed task forces to the Mediterranean, prepared to rescue the hostages on TWA Flight 847, which had been hijacked by Shia terrorists and eventually flown to Beirut, as well as the Achille Lauro, which was a cruise liner hijacked by Palestinian terrorists and sailed around the eastern Mediterranean. But on each occasion, the White House never gave the green light for action. You know, and it was experiences like this that led General Pete Schoomaker, who commanded JSOC in the mid-1990s, to compare JSOC during this period to a brand new Ferrari that was being kept in the garage out of concern that if it was taken out to race, the fender might get dented. That's the story of why JSOC didn't conduct the sort of missions that it was originally created to conduct, the sort of the classic hostage rescue missions that seemed to be sort of all the rage in the late 70s. But they did conduct quite a few real-world missions to include spearheading the invasions of both Grenada in 1983 and Panama in 1989, several manhunting operations, including the hunt for Pablo Escobar, in which they worked, you know, very closely with Colombian, Pablo Escobar being a Colombian cocaine kingpin in the early 1990s, and they worked very closely with Colombian security forces there. The hunt, unsuccessful hunt at the time for Mohamed Farah Aidid, the Somali warlord, which ended in the October 1993 Battle of Mogadishu, memorialized in the book and the movie Black Hawk Down, as well as in the aftermath of the Dayton Peace Accords in the mid-90s, JSOC was given the mission of hunting down Balkan War criminals to be put on trial at The Hague.
And they were actually very successful with that, if I understand right.
Yes, they were. There were quite a number of successful snatches and or in one or two cases kills in that period in the Balkans, and they involved some fairly out of the box methods as well, including, you know, in at least one case I believe a catapult net that was fired at a moving car to ensnare it and immobilize it so that operators could then emerge from the hedgerows and smash the windows in and drag their target out. And
do they have a lot of things like that? I mean, do they? That does sound like something I've never heard of before.
Yeah, they probably had a few. I mean, I know that they were experimenting with ways to remotely sort of interfere with cars by that period. I one suspects that for all the sort of juicy detail that's in my book, I would imagine that the stuff that these days might be the most cutting edge is probably retained in just a few mines at Fort Bragg and Damneck, Virginia.
All right, so they go through these first kind of 20 years, and then September 11th happens. What kind of position was JSOC in at that time, and then how were they used in the first few months after September 11th?
On September the 11th, 2001, JSOC was actually about to start one of what had become its sort of massive quarterly exercises, which were called Joint Readiness Exercises, or JRXs. And this one had a JSOC task force headquartered at a military airfield in Tazar, Hungary, with small elements scattered all across Europe. And the focus of the exercise, as with most such JSOC exercises by then, was counter-proliferation. JSOC had in the 1980s been handed the mission of counter-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And this exercise was sort of a loose nuke exercise. But the exercise also exemplified what many insiders felt had become a problem, which was that JSOC had become wedded to this operational template in which a big headquarters and many hundreds of personnel had to be airlifted on dozens of transport aircraft to conduct any mission that JSOC was given. And in the critic's eyes, this robbed JSOC of its ability to respond nimbly, let alone clandestinely.
Right, yeah, not very stealthy if it takes takes a whole squadron to get you there.
If you have to fly C-5 after C-5 or C-17 after C-17 big transport aircraft anywhere, it's very difficult to keep that secret from the locals.
Someone's going to notice.
Yeah.
Someone's really going to notice.
The initial plans on how to use JSOC in Afghanistan in the immediate wake of 9/11 sort of seemed to confirm the sort of critics' view that JSOC had become this sort of unwieldy, top-heavy organization. You know, the JSOC commander at the time, Major General Del Daley, wanted to use JSOC to make a statement rather than to sort of to hunt down and kill the most senior Al-Qaeda and Taliban figures. Although it should be said that he was probably coming under some pressure from his military and civilian chain of command in this regard. So JSOC actually spent a number of weeks planning a raid on a fertilizer plant in northern Afghanistan that some sort of very thin, dubious intelligence reports had suggested might be a chemical or biological weapons facility. You know, and the idea was that Delta Force were going to assault this facility. But when the lead Delta Force planner in JSOC's planning team proposed a very stealthy raid, Daley, the JSOC commander, got angry and indicated that, you know, what he actually wanted was a big televised production. Now, in the end, the raid didn't happen as JSOC found out that it was initially looking at targets in northern Afghanistan because it thought it was going to have to fly out of Central Asia into Afghanistan to do the raids. But once it found that it could base itself on the island of Masira off of Oman and use an aircraft carrier to launch raids into the Taliban's heartland in southern Afghanistan, the targets in northern Afghanistan just faded in importance, which was probably just as well because the fertilizer factory turned out later to be just that.
I guess we saved ourselves a little bit of embarrassment there. Is Joint Special Operations Command likely to be participating in a fight against Islamic State? If so, what kind of roles would you think it would have?
Yes, it already is participating in that fight and has been actually for some time. JSOC has a task force operating out of Iraqi Kurdistan, basically working with the CIA to target Islamic State leadership. So when you hear about a drone strike taking out a senior Islamic State figure, there's a good chance that a JSOC targeting folder was, at the root of that. And JSOC has its own drones that are conducting those missions. JSOC has also been involved in multiple raids into Islamic State held territory, including the July 2014 raid that just missed James Foley and the other U.S. And as I detail in my book, that raid was notable in part because JSOC used the same model, roughly, of stealth Black Hawk helicopter that it used in the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad. You know, one of which famously crash landed at the compound.
Right, in which they then at least made an effort to destroy so that the secrets wouldn't be made available to the Pakistanis, right?
That's right, but unfortunately, whatever they used, probably thermite grenades to destroy the airframe, left the tail boom intact.
So there's one thing that you mentioned really early on when we're talking about the various constituents that fit under JSOC. I'm just really curious about the stealth aircraft. You said it was part of the Air Force, and how do they operate? I mean, do they look like commercial liners, or?
Yeah, and I just want to be clear on the terminology. So the stealth helicopters that I was talking about are the ones with stealthy characteristics, but they're military helicopters. sort of like a stealth fighter, same idea. The covered aircraft, I believe, is what you're referring to. The Air Force and in fact, the Army in Delta Force both have covered aircraft capabilities. Task Force Orange also has covered aircraft. So you've got a minimum of three sets of aircraft, as I'm counting. The Air Force unit includes larger aircraft that can sort of fly a force somewhere, but it looks like it's just another sort of regular civilian sort of cargo plane. Delta Force unit, which is Delta's E Squadron or Echo Squadron, is mostly helicopters, and they do a variety of tasks, but mostly they move folks from A to B undercover, or they can be weaponized in a foreign country, and you know, so you fly in a civilian helicopter, basically add weapons to it at a remote airfield somewhere in, you know, Central America or somewhere else, and then you've got an attack helicopter, and then Task Force Orange, the sort of intelligence unit, uses a fleet of aircraft to carry its signals intelligence gear, and so you know, they can also be made to appear quite benign.
Back to your book, while you were doing the research for it, what was the most surprising thing you discovered, or have you been involved in this reporting on this for such a long time that none of it was particularly surprising to you?
No, there were a few. There were a few things that I was sort of surprised at, or sort of really impressed by. One was the missions that we've already talked about into Syria, the undercover espionage missions. And another was, this is actually, I believe, a CIA accomplishment. But JSOC and CIA were both involved in the hunt for Al-Awlaki, the Yemeni American preacher who was part of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and he was killed.
He was the publisher of Inspire as well, yeah, which is an English language publication intended to lure Westerners to join the jihad, I think.
And I was told by somebody involved in that the CIA actually had managed to install a camera in the car that Awlaki was riding in that was transmitting moving pictures in real time, you know, sort of basically installed in the dashboard or something, looking backwards, and was able to transmit pictures in real time that proved that Awlaki was actually riding in the vehicle, that allowed the CIA, I believe at that time, to pull the trigger on the drone, as it were, and kill him. I think there was also the fact that SEAL Team 6 for years trained for and kept a unit on standby in Afghanistan for a mission to conduct a free-fall parachute jump into the Pakistani tribal areas if actionable intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts was ever obtained. So that was the actual plan A for a long time, was...
Like a halo jump?
Yeah, it would have been probably a hey-ho jump. So high altitude, high opening. So in other words, you jump out of the plane at, you know, maybe 25,000 feet, maybe just a plane flying along the Afghanistan side of the border, and then you use your sort of free-fall parachute to steer yourself to a very, riding on the wind, as it were, to a very precise location. And you know, SEAL Team 6 trained for this so often that they could put, you know, dozens of operators down at the same point, maybe 20 or 30 kilometers from where they'd jumped out of the plane.
Impressive as that is, it also proves out that we really had no idea where bin Laden was.
That's correct. Although he wasn't always in Abbottabad, obviously. Even when he was detected in Abbottabad and the planning was underway for the mission that became Operation Neptune's Spear, a mission to kill him in Abbottabad, some in Team 6 felt more comfortable doing the freefall mission to get him, even though it would probably have required flying some distance into Pakistan before the operators jumped out of the plane, than they were with the stealth helicopter approach, which was what JSOC commander Bill McRaven eventually opted for.
There's one aspect of your book that I'm kind of interested in. I hadn't really thought about it too much until I read a review in Foreign Policy, which you actually write for, right?
Yes, yeah, I'm a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, yes. And previously was a staff writer there.
The headline on the piece was Naylor's book is very good, but I've got some issues with the people who blabbed. And I'm sure you remember the article. It brings up, the point of the article seems to be not just to praise your book, but to say that, you know, now all of the good tricks are, you know, out of the bag, and, you know, this will actually compromise the effectiveness of JSOC. And I wondered if that was something, whether or not it's true, I wonder if that was something that at all concerned you while you were doing the work on the book.
It certainly did. You know, I obviously had to trust my sources in many cases, who are, if anything, far more invested in keeping information that would be of real value to an enemy of the United States secret. And especially, you know, because they'd grown up in JSOC and in the special mission units. And, you know, I sort of had to trust that if somebody with many years of experience is telling me something, that he or she has come to the conclusion that this is not actually dangerous. Bear in mind that my book covers 30 plus years of history, 34 years of history. So much of the action and many of the techniques that are being described are years old. Just because something was cutting edge in 2005 or 2008 doesn't mean it's cutting edge in late 2015. So, I mean, that would be one obvious point that I would make. And I actually kept a number of names, for instance, out of the book at people's request. I think that the JSOC story is very important. It's been the U.S. military's main effort in the war on terror. And sort of keeping it hidden from the U.S. public would be like keeping secret the accomplishments of Patton's Third Army in Europe during World War II. You know, and the American people funded JSOC at considerable, albeit classified, expense. You know, they've filled it with their sons and daughters, and it is waging war in their name. And others disagree, and I respect their views, but I think the American public has every right to know the history of this command and its extraordinary people.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's the perfect note to end on. So, Sean Naylor, it's terrific to speak with you today. We really appreciate your time. And just also, I figure it can't hurt to mention the name of your book again. It's also going to be posted along with links to everything else. Relentless Strike, The Secret History of Joint Special Operations Command. And is that available now?
Oh, yes. It is available
it's
now.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then last but not least, I just want to beg our listeners to, if you like this, please subscribe to the podcast, and comments on iTunes or SoundCloud are very much appreciated. Your ratings, for good or for ill, can help decide the fate of this podcast. So, once again, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Next time on War College.
It's tempting to think that anything that moved us along and got us closer to our current reality is progress, but we have nothing to compare it to. We took the fork in the road, and anything that got us to that fork in the road is positive, but what if the fork in the road that we're on isn't as good as the fork in the road we could have been on?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.